The following is a presentation of the Six Arrows Radio Network.
Today on The Workbench, we open the junk drawer and find real treasure. Interviews from Pacificon, Powerfilm Solar discount coupon, and G8BBC is on the air from London, England. Stay tuned. Welcome to The Workbench. I'm your host, George, KJ6VU.
And I'm Jeremy, KF7IJZ.
This episode of The Workbench is brought to you by Elecraft, makers of high-performance radios, amplifiers, and other great station accessories. Check them out at www.elecraft.com. And by Autodesk, the makers of Eagle PCB design tools, the software we use to design all of our Workbench build projects. For more info and your free copy of Eagle, go to www.autodesk.com/eagle today.
Welcome to the Ham Radio 360 Workbench Podcast, your bi-weekly deep dive into making, DIY, tinkering, technical topics of interest to the radio amateur. I am back again. George is back again, and we have brought you another episode.
Jeremy, how are you tonight?
I am fantastic. Now, for those of you who have subscribed to this podcast or are looking at this on the website and you have seen the title Junk Drawer, I have to imagine you're intrigued.
What sort of image does Junk Drawer evoke in your mind?
I mean, I think of this as all great hobbyists. All of us have a drawer filled with everything that did not fit into some other category to get put somewhere else.
Well, at least one. Most of them.
In a recent mode of cleaning up my office, I had a drawer that was literally just a holding tank, and I pulled everything out of there from like SMA terminated, you know, 1 foot, 2 foot long RG316 jumpers to an old set of power pole crimpers that I had gotten from Harbor Freight when I first started.
So these are all the odds and ends that don't have an official place.
Yes. Which covers our show tonight perfectly.
But it doesn't mean that the items themselves are of less value.
In fact, how many times have you gone to your junk drawer and have found that one thing that you've spent 20, 30 minutes looking for that was exactly what you needed to finish a project?
Oh, yeah. All the time. And what goes in the junk drawer is stuff that you're keeping. And looking at the topics for tonight's show, actually, we've got some really great stuff.
So, George, what are we going to be covering tonight?
We have a bunch of things. So part of what we want to do tonight is talk about the status of some projects we're working on. We talked about build projects, and we've got a lot of email from listeners who want to know when the power monitor boards are going to be available or the antenna relay boards and other stuff. So I want to talk about projects. And then Pacificon was just a couple weeks ago, and I had a chance to get some really good interviews with some folks at Pacificon, from Flex Radio, from Stepper Antennas, and from Novexcom, who makes 19-inch rack panel GoBox hardware that's very nice. And there is also a pretty big event happening in the UK. And that is the start up again of a station at the BBC. G8BBC is now back on the air, and that's a ham radio station at the BBC's headquarters at Broadcasting House. And there is a event at that announcement, that sort of unveiling, and that was recorded by our friends at the ICQ podcast, and they were kind enough to offer that audio to us to allow us to distribute it here on the show.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, it was very nice of them.
But of course, before we deep dive into any of those things, we also brought everybody a surprise.
We did. When we talked about Powerfilm solar panels, we had a giveaway, and several hundred people signed up, and Powerfilm did give away the 30-watt solar panel. And then they came back to us and said, you know, we would be willing to do a special deal, a discount for any of your listeners with a special promo code.
So we're going to hear a little bit more about that, but the timing is perfect because the holiday season is upon us. You know, as we traditionally do, we do get into shopping shows. George and myself both highly recommend Power Film equipment. It is something that I have run two full field days off of, and I'm a big fan of. It's fantastic for QRP, portable work, and let's take a moment and listen to what Power Film has to offer us.
I'd like to welcome back Seth Hansen from Power Film Solar. Hey, Seth, how you doing?
I am well. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, actually. And we wanted to get you back on here to the workbench for a couple of reasons. First thing is that back in episode 34, we announced the winner of the 30-watt Power Film solar panel. Mm-hmm. And as far as I know, I don't think we've heard from the winner, have we?
Yeah, I reached out on air. I'm gonna try to re-engage Jim. The winner was Jim Zalumski, so I'm going to give him about a week. And then after that week, if I don't hear back, you know, via email or however I'm going to contact him, we'll just find somebody else who entered, and then they'll be the winner.
Okay, so Jim needs to get on the stick and send you an email. Otherwise, he would have been the winner of the Power Film Solar panel.
Right.
And he'll be kicking himself around the block if he doesn't respond fast enough.
Hopefully he does.
Hopefully he does. So that's great. So hopefully he'll get it and he'll enjoy his panel. And I think we had a remarkable response to the giveaway.
It was very cool. I think the contest was 30 days and we received over 400 people. So that's always encouraging to see that level of engagement. Clearly there's a desire and an interest for solar.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a big interest in the listener base for this show. I think a lot of us are interested in doing portable operating or preparing for some potential natural disaster or just about any situation where having portable power would be really essential. So I'm not surprised that we got a good response, but 400 was really more than I expected, frankly.
Yeah, it was super encouraging. So talked a little bit about it internally, and we decided we kind of put together what we're calling our ham radio bundle. It's a 30-watt, so it's the same panel that we were giving away, a 30-watt foldable solar panel, and the anchor, it's the Anderson Power Pole connector adapter, because Anderson Power Pole, you know, for the majority of hams is the connector of choice. So we're just putting that adapter in with it, and we're offering that for a 10% off discount. So that currently is available right now. All you have to do to take advantage of the 30-watt ham bundle, is what we're calling it, is go to www.powerfilmsolar.com/products/workbench. And then on that page, it just says what I just said, 10% off. And the promo code that you'll use on Amazon is ham radio with a capital H and a capital R.
Oh, that's awesome. So 10% off on the same 30-watt panel plus the power pole connector adapter.
Yep, absolutely.
So perfect for soda. That sounds awesome. Hey, thanks so much. That's really nice of you to do that for our listeners.
Yeah, we everybody can't win, but hopefully this gives individuals an incentive to try out using our technology and to make it a little more affordable. 10% off is a decent amount on this product.
Yeah, well, every bit helps, and maybe that's just the push people need to get one. And don't forget, Christmas is coming.
Yeah, so
this
absolutely
would make an awesome stocking stuffer.
Oh my goodness, yes.
If you want to have a present for the ham who you don't know what to get for the ham, like, kind of seriously, the best presents are the ones that you want, but you would never buy it for yourself.
And, oh, totally.
You know, sometimes something like this might fall into that category where you'd think, man, I'd love to have one of those things, but maybe this is just the push you need for your, you know, your son, your uncle, your wife, your cousin, or whoever needs a solar panel.
Right. And then just to your point for a gift, this deal will be going until December 7th. We do some fulfillment on Amazon, so this will be through Amazon. It will be available until December 7th. And that URL, one more time, just navigate to www.powerfilmsolar.com/products/workbench. And that has all the details and how you can take advantage of the discount.
That's awesome. Hey, thanks so much, Seth. Appreciate it. And let's get you guys back on here soon and talk more about the technology.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
So once again, I want to thank Seth from Power Film Solar to make that really nice offer for our listeners. In fact, we did put a posting on the Facebook page about a week ago that this was going to happen, and we've already had some listeners who've taken advantage of that deal. So we're happy to be able to do that, and Power Film was very grateful for all the great feedback from our listeners, and we hope that you guys get some great stocking stuffers.
Or large packages under the tree.
Nothing says happy holidays like a new solar panel.
Yeah, my I think it's the model number is the 7200, which is the 120 watt panel. That would be a pretty big stocking to put in.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, like when you're a dad and you buy a mitt for your kid, but the kid's like 3 months old. I wonder if that same logic applies where if I wanted a 30 watt power film solar panel and I got one for, I don't know, my spouse or my kid, would that be, it wouldn't be appreciated, would it?
You know, I've got a funny story about this.
What's that?
Well, my father-in-law, 1 year from my mother-in-law's birthday, bought her a John Cougar Mellencamp album, which was his favorite artist at the time.
Well, there you go.
She did not appreciate it in the way that it was intended.
I'd rather have the solar panel.
But he thoroughly enjoyed it.
You know who the easiest guy in the world was to buy Christmas presents for?
No clue.
My father-in-law, because he was a ham, N6 PST. So every year it was a total no-brainer because there was always a tool or a ham radio gadget that could be useful. And likewise for me, every Christmas there'd be like a pan of ice or, you know, yet another tool to go in the workbench. And it was like, thank goodness somebody understands me.
That must have been pretty nice.
It was awesome. He was a great guy.
All right. Well, speaking of workbenches, but before we get to them, George, anything in the news worth sharing?
You know, I just ran across one thing, in fact, today. So you guys may know there's a magazine called, I guess you pronounce it, Elector out of Europe, E-L-E-C-K-T-O-R. And it's a great electronics hobbyist magazine. And they also have an online store and other things that they make available. Well, anyway, I subscribe to their mailing list. And in the mailing, they usually talk about articles that are in the magazine or things they're selling or project examples. And one of the things that I saw in their announcement email today was a really cool piece of software. This is a Android piece of software, and I think it's free. And it is a function generator all done in software. And so the whole idea behind this guy's article was to say that when you look at a modern Android cell phone or tablet, that there's a lot of useful hardware, of course, in that device, like an accelerometer, a thermometer, cameras, a display, audio circuitry, Wi-Fi, touchscreen, all that jazz. And as a platform, you could do some cool things with it, including making that into a piece of test equipment. And there's some good examples out there of using these tablets and phones as oscilloscopes and other things. Well, this piece of software is a two-channel function generator. And a function generator is basically a baseband signal generator that puts out like a sine wave or a triangle wave or a square wave at a frequency and an amplitude that you can specify. So, for example, if you want to test your transmitter, let's say you're building a little, let's say like an all-star hotspot, something we talked about on a show recently, and you want to test your little handy talkie that you're using as the transmitter, you could just take your pad, plug the audio output into the modulator of the transmitter, and generate a sine wave audio tone off of your tablet. And what's cool about it is not only can you generate a single tone, but you can have a sweep. So you can go from like 100 hertz to 3 kilohertz or whatever and see what the frequency response is. So for cheap to free, you could make your tablet into a nice little audio function generator.
Well, that's not bad.
Yeah, no, it's very nice. And the user interface looks like, looks like a little piece of test equipment. And you pick the waveform and if you want to sweep it or if you want to generate noise, etc. And it just uses the audio stereo output as the output port of the actual signal itself.
So does that mean that there's a bandwidth limit?
I'm sure there is. And it's probably a function of the audio, of course, the audio output circuitry. But I'm not sure what the upper end is. Certainly anything in the range of frequencies you can hear would be supported, but I don't know how much higher it would go than that. So let's just say for the sake of argument, maybe it's like 0 to 15 kilohertz. I mean, normal human hearing at the high end is about 20 kilohertz, but I'm not sure exactly how high this would go. It's possible it might be even higher than that.
Well, cool. By the way, you misspelled elector.
Oh, did I?
Yeah,
E-L-E-K-T-O-R.
Yep. It's a K, yeah. Not a C. It's European. Of course it's a K.
Yeah, of course. Actually, I'm taking a quick check here, looking at the article. There's a nice article that talks all about this. And the fellow who did this work, his name is Jan Buiting, B-U-I-T-I-N-G. And he's a ham, of course, and also an electronics hobbyist enthusiast. So you can see some great pictures of his write up about the software and exactly how it works.
So are you aware of any other apps or accessories for mobile devices? I mean, because you mentioned, oscilloscopes, which I seem to recall maybe about 4 or 5 years ago, seeing some other type of like pocket test equipment that could interface with the mobile device. Are you aware of anything else?
Oh yeah. I've actually tried several things. And some of them use just the hardware of the tablet or the phone by itself. In other words, just the audio jack, either in or out. And there's other devices where there's actually a piece of electronics that's between the tablet and the thing you're actually testing. And that could be an amplifier or an analog to digital converter or a buffer or something just to isolate or amplify the signal. So in other words, let's say, for instance, one of the common applications is an oscilloscope, and you could use the microphone input on the tablet as the audio input channel, and then the tablet could display the audio signal. One way to do that is just to run an audio signal straight into your phone or tablet and use the ADC, the analog to digital converter, in the device to sample and then use the software to display it. Or you might want to have some sort of electronics in between to protect it or to amplify it, like I said, or change the range even for that matter. So yeah, there's actually quite a few. So you'll find if you go on the Google Play Store or to the iOS Apple Store, there's several oscilloscope programs. There's also some logic analyzer programs. There are some function generators like this one here. This one looked really nice. There's a few that are a bit more communications oriented that'll do things like DTMF, touch tone generation. I think there's probably some audio frequency spectrum analyzers, which are actually pretty slick. And they'll do like a spectral plot in real time, as well as the waterfall where you can see the spectrum changing over time. You know, those things are very common on a PC or Mac, and now you start to see more of those things on the tablet. In fact, there's test equipment software like that. There's also some analog circuit simulators that are essentially SPICE on a tablet for very simple circuit simulation, which is kind of fun to play around with.
You know, actually, man, so I'm an iOS user. I do own one Android tablet from 2013. I think it was the Nexus 7 version 2 that I purchased because at the time I had need of having access to an Android device. And I remember I had a really amazing visual circuit simulator, and like it would even do things like render current flowing on the lines, and you know, in components, like it would actually like change the velocity of how the current was shown and stuff to really give you an idea of like what your signal was doing in the circuit. It was really cool. I'll have to try to find what that was and maybe put it in the show notes.
You know, this is a really good topic for a whole nother show where we can talk about design tools for electronic circuit design for you know, Linux, PC, Macs, as well as mobile devices. It's a little harder to do this stuff on a mobile device because it's hard to manipulate circuitry like a schematic editor with, you know, any more than a half a dozen parts on your tablet. And really, a PC is much more appropriate platform for that. But, you know, to do simple circuitry, you can certainly do that on a tablet. There's a really good one that I played with on the iOS platform called, was it Every Circuit? I think it's what it's called.
So oddly enough, that is the exact app I was talking about.
Oh, no kidding.
Yep.
Oh, that's great. It's actually a very nice program. It has a nice little circuit editor. And like you said, it's dynamic on the display. And you know, what's actually good about it is I think a lot of us learn this stuff visually more than, you know, mathematically. And if you, let's say you do a simple circuit, like just a battery and a resistor and an LED, and you hook that up and simulate it on your phone, and you can kind of see, you know, the current flow and how things work. And then you can go to more complicated things with transistors and other devices. It's a great way to learn basically how circuits work.
Yes, it is. And it's highly visual, and it's neat to kind of just drag things around or change values and get an understanding of what's happening. You know, and that application has been around for since at least 2013 or so. It still seems alive and well. So there's been a lot of good development going on with it.
Yeah, and there's some example circuits in there too. So it's not like you're starting from scratch. If you just want to dink around for a few minutes, you can load the program and then just open up a sample circuit and run it and just see what happens and maybe change some component values or manipulate the circuit layout and see what happens. It's quite nice, actually.
Now, another app that I have used, which basically allows you to, if you have an Android device that supports an on-the-go USB connection, which of course, for those of you not familiar, there's a special cable you can purchase that will plug into the micro USB connector on your Android device. And then the other side of it is a USB-A jack. And what this allows you to do is connect USB devices through what is traditionally just the charging or data port. And it's that on the go that allows you to, that allows the port to kind of switch modes into a host instead of being a client. The app is called SDR Touch for Android. And what it allows you to do is actually plug in one of the common inexpensive RTL-based TV tuner-style dongles, plug it into your Android device, and you basically have a very poor man's lo-fi, you know, SDR receiver and spectrum analyzer.
Oh, very nice.
So I played around with that a little bit. I'm not sure how well developed or supported that still is. I know it's still available. It's a neat little application to be able to plug a device into and get going.
Well, I think for a lot of hardware projects, it's easy to do the guts of the electronics, you know, a circuit board with components like we talk about all the time, but it's harder to do a user interface. In other words, buttons and a display and all that stuff. A lot of commercial products out there today use tablets and phones as the user interface because it's cheaper, like a little scope. So I think that'll be a trend. I think there'll just be a lot more of that sort of stuff. If you could connect to a physical device and just operate through the UI of the tablet, it's much cheaper. Well, in fact, later on in the show, one of the interviews that we did with Flux Radio, I'm talking with Mike about the Maestro, which is a control head essentially to allow you to use the radio. You know, the volume pot and the tuning knob and all that stuff is on the control head, the Maestro. And the display is this big, gorgeous color tablet display. So I think they actually incorporate a tablet into the physical package.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think it's just a raw display. I think it actually is a tablet underneath. But anyway, so and the fact that the tablets are produced in huge volume, the price is so low that it's you know, they're really cheap. I mean, they can be very inexpensive and make great user interfaces.
So on Android, there's another app called RF Analyzer, which looks like it has a higher rating. I haven't played with it, but it advertises compatibility with RTL SDR dongles as well as the HackRF1.
Well, and there's tons of ham radio, you know, digital mode software that has like the audio spectral display and things like that to go along with it. So, yeah, so I think we should do a show sometime in 18 about design tools, about simulators and other design aids.
So speaking of software-defined radio, so one of the things that this isn't necessarily news, but it's something I want to bring to folks' attention because I think this is going to be available probably before the end of the calendar year. As you guys know, we are big fans of AirSpy equipment and the software that Yusuf has created, which is SDR Sharp, and a companion application called Spy Server. And there is a new AirSpy that is, I've been seeing it on Twitter a lot because Yusuf has been sending these to folks who develop other popular software-defined radio packages such as SDR Console. So he's been sending them to a lot of colleagues and friends and, you know, for evaluation. But it's called the AirSpy HF Plus. And
what's
this,
that?
So it is a... basically two receivers in one. One is an HF receiver that's DC to 31 megahertz. The other is a VHF receiver that is 60 to 260 megahertz. But this receiver is a little bit different than the standard AirSpies because what it is designed for is incredible sensitivity.
And selectivity too?
Well, it's a direct sampled signal, right? So this is one of those areas where I know that you can do pre-selection and bandpass filtering and things like that. Because I can't speak expertly on it, like I don't want to say that. There's a link to all the specs. So for the people who, you know, really care about like the third order intercept point and, you know, the sensitivity for, you know, different signals, all of that stuff is available on the site. But a few things that are kind of really unique about this is, first of all, unlike the full-size AirSpy where you have an effective 8 megahertz of bandwidth available, this is only going to give you approximately 660 kilohertz, which for an HF receiver is more than enough. Even for tuning into things in the VHF spectrum, still more than enough for a single that's hard to say, single signal. So this isn't designed necessarily for looking at large swaths of spectrum and clicking around. It really is more for you are trying to tune things that are specific. The reviews that have been out there basically point out that its HF performance is ridiculous. It is an incredibly low noise device. The majority of its reception in HF is below negative 140 dBm. Mm. Which is, that's a very good figure. But the, you know, all the testing, all the rave reviews of the maybe they're not pre-production units, but the earliest units being made have been really good. And I'm bringing this up because I'm excited about getting my hands on one, first of all. But it, like I said, the goal I think he has is to have these available for sale before the end of the year. And I think they are going to be targeted for well under $200 US.
So the frequency range is HF, or does it go above HF?
Yeah, so it's DC to 31 megahertz on the HF port, and then the VHF port is 60 to 260 megahertz.
You just said that, didn't you?
I did. That's okay. I don't listen to our show either.
I don't actually listen while we're recording. Come on.
If any of this means stuff to you, and again, I probably should know this stuff since I'm a co-host on a ham radio podcast. The sensitivity figures of negative 140 dBm at 500 hertz of bandwidth in HF, negative 141 in FM broadcast, negative 142 in VHF airband, negative 140.5 in VHF commercial, which covers our amateur 2 meter band, and negative 139 above 174 megahertz. Plus 15 dBm third order intercept point on HF at max gain, plus 13 on VHF, 110 dB blocking dynamic range in HF, 95 dB blocking dynamic range in VHF, 120 dB of image rejection based on software, up to 660 kilohertz of alias free bandwidth, 768 kilosample IQ, an 18-bit digital down converter, a plus 10 dBm for maximum RF input, 0.5 ppm high resolution low phase lock noise, low phase noise clock. That's hard to say.
Easy for you to say.
Two high dynamic range Sigma Delta ADCs up to 36 megasamples per second. Very clean RF path. Again, folks have been really, really impressed with the performance of this thing. And so I think, you know, for well under $200, and this is my estimate, this hasn't been posted yet. But for somebody who wants like a very, very good receiver and that's software controlled, this is exciting. And, you know, this actually kind of ties into my workbench topic, which I guess we'll go ahead and move to that.
So tell us about the workbench project.
Okay. So honestly, I've had a lot of stuff happening in my personal work life lately, so there hasn't really been much time to tinker with much. But have we talked about groups.io before?
Perhaps. We moved our club to groups.io.
Okay. So a lot of really good ham radio content still exists on Yahoo groups. But there is a more modern system that has been developed called groups.io. They even have a function that if you have a Yahoo group, you can relatively easily import the content from said group over there. Yusuf runs an AirSpy group on groups.io, which I'll make sure to put in the show notes. And what's really awesome is as the developer of the hardware and the software, he's very active in this group. But there's been a ton of traffic because he has been super busy, super, super busy making a lot of improvements to the SDR Sharp application, but more importantly, the Spy Server application. For a quick refresher, the Spy Server application is a little app that is available as a Windows binary, a Linux binary, and then compiled also for 32-bit ARM, so things like the Raspberry Pi, the Tinkerboard, the Odroid. It's an application that basically, assuming you have done the work to, like in Linux, on either ARM or this, there's a set of tools that you need to pull down and compile to make the devices work. In Windows, it is pretty much plug and play. But it basically allows you to plug in one-to-many AirSpy devices or even RTL-SDR dongles, like the official RTL-SDR dongles. And it allows you to make them available over your network. And what's different about like some of the other tools available, it's not just like a USB to TCP/IP bridge. Mm-hmm. His software actually does processing that does the decoding of the signal. So like when you tell it to do sideband decoding, if it were plugged into your computer running SDR Sharp, your computer would do it. But in this case, whatever you are running Spy Server on, Spy Server itself is doing the decoding of the signals. It is also doing the processing of the incoming raw IQ data into what becomes the waterfall. So what this allows you to do is it allows you to have a very bandwidth efficient way of connecting to one of these receivers over the network. I think I mentioned before that upstairs in a spare bedroom, I have a Tinkerboard running with an AirSpy R2 and an AirSpy Mini plugged into it. One connected to a basically a VHF plus discone, the other connected to a random wire and a 9-in-1 Balun. And I have one set up for HF, one set up for VHF. And I can basically, over my network, connect to this thing, point SDR sharp at it, and then, you know, be able to receive stuff from anywhere in the house on my Windows tablet here at my desktop that I'm recording the podcast from, you know, pretty much any machine that I can run SDR sharp on.
And can you get to that from outside the house too?
So if I wanted to do the work to punch a hole in my firewall and route traffic out and to be able to respond incoming connections, yes, I could. The protocol is just TCP. There is no UDP component to it. But he has done a ton of work to make it super bandwidth efficient. Probably well beyond the time that we have to talk about this, but I mean, he's added some features to reduce sample size, basically going from 16-bit frames to 8-bit frames, but he's doing a lot of processing in SPI server to determine, in other words, instead of in out of 16 bits, if you're using a lot of that data to bring noise with your signal, he's doing pre-processing so that in the 8 bits of dynamic range you're going to get over the network, that he's really focusing on the important part of the signal in the signal-to-noise package, if that makes sense. So he's basically shifting where the sampling is occurring to get stuff that is truly signal. And because of this, it allows it to be very bandwidth efficient. This application has been, you know, really good. I used to get the full like 4 megahertz of bandwidth, down. It was using like 128 kilobytes per second, which on a local network really isn't much at all. But now with some of the changes he made with this new 8-bit mode, it's down to like 60 kilobytes per second. So the other reason that I'm kind of bringing this up, in addition to just being excited about this, and I mean, there's, like I said, he's made a ton of changes to the applications over the last, I'm looking at the change log, 2-3 weeks. I mean, he's just been very, very busy. But he has a new listing on his website. So if you are interested in seeing what all the fuss is about with an introduction to software-defined radio, but specifically what the AirSpy and SDR Sharp are capable of, he now has on his website a public directory of people who are sharing their AirSpies over the internet, that you can download the SDR Sharp software for free, and basically connect to these servers that folks have set up so that you can actually play with it.
So does that mean that you can actually connect to remote servers?
Oh, yes, absolutely. These are live servers. Looking at his list on the website now, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 servers in the list. You know, he runs one, several other folks do. And what's neat about this software is it's very configurable. So for instance, one of these on here is set up for VHF, and it is limited to 136 to 138 megahertz. And it is made specifically for, I'm trying to remember. I think it's WeatherFax or a weather satellite area. So, you know, they've got that bandwidth limited. You could set it up so that you can limit how many people connect to it. You can also limit what people can do as far as tuning. Because in all fairness, if you set it up and say, okay, for an AirSpy R2, which gives you, again, 8 megahertz of usable bandwidth, you could say, okay, if there's only one person connected to it, and you know the thing is set up that can receive from DC to daylight, you can let the single user tune anywhere they want to. Or maybe you only have it hooked up to, say, an 80 meter dipole. You can limit it and say only tune within the 80 meter band.
Okay, so when we had the hurricanes happening, and I was listening on some web SDRs, I'm sure that they weren't all AirSpies, but there are some web SDR software that was very similar to that, where you would go to some guy's website, and he was in like Pennsylvania, but he only would let you listen on 40 and 20. And then you go to some other guy's website here in California, and maybe that was open on 80 meters as well. So I guess you know, similar kind of thing where if you host that, you could decide what the thing actually can do.
Yep. And you can even set it up that if one person's connected, they have full freedom. If more than one people connect, it will limit what the band is, where it's tuned. And then, you can set up between two and many folks have the ability to tune around in that bandwidth, mm-hmm. but they can't actually take it off like the center frequency. I mean, the big difference between this and web SDR is there has been a huge focus on being bandwidth efficient with this. There's all the processing is done on the server software, and the client is the SDR Sharp application. When you first run SDR Sharp, in the top left-hand corner, there's a drop-down of a number of different hardware to select from, and one of them is Spy Server. You put in an IP address or a host name and a port number, you hit connect, and bada boom. So if you are really curious what all the fuss is about, and I mean, this is why I love this hardware and the software, because it's not realistic or convenient for the computer I spend the most of my time at to actually run the hardware off of this. It's much better that I have a VHF antenna on the second floor of my house. It's plugged into my Ethernet. It's fantastic. But if you want to see what all the fuss is about, check out the show notes. I've got links to the groups.io, which there are actually even more servers in there, because there are people all the time popping up and saying, hey, I put one online here. No, I don't want to list it in the official directory, but feel free to go play around with it. For a while, actually, Yusuf, the one he has online right now, is actually one of the AirSpy HF Pluses. In fact, looking at this list, 1, 2, 3, 4 of these units out of the 9 are HF Pluses. But he's got it set up for VHF right now and was commenting that there was like a really good jazz station in Paris that you can tune into.
Very nice.
But I mean, this distributed radio thing, especially for somebody like me who can't put up a ton of antennas, it's super nice.
I just think this whole remote radio thing in all of its forms is really just a big wave, because I mean, how many of us live in cities or even in suburban areas where you can't put up an antenna, or maybe you can, but you want to listen to something on VHF in another town? It just seems like that with, the obvious connectivity of the internet, you could do this all over the place. So I think we're going to see a lot more of this.
Well, and the best part is there are two things I love about it. First of all, as far as bang for your buck in ham radio, even to get started with an AirSpy dongle, which is going to be, more bandwidth in a higher quality receiver than an RTL SDR. But I mean, so, okay, an RTL SDR is $20-$25. Moving up to an AirSpy is going to be $99, but that's still only four times as expensive as a good Baofeng. That's actually been my favorite thing about the last 2 years in ham radio. There were so many amazing things you can do for like between $100 and $150. Whereas I remember when I started, my FT60 was like the cheapest radio you could buy, and it was still $200 just to start. And that's not counting an extra battery, an antenna, programming cable, whatever. These things allow you to have a lot of capability, a lot of opportunities to play around. And again, the reason I'm bringing this one up is you don't have to spend any money. Go download SDR Sharp on your Windows computer and connect to one of these servers and check it out.
Do you remember a couple episodes ago, I think I mentioned there's a guy here in California who lived in a location where he could not put up an outside antenna. So he put up an antenna, HF antenna, in his attic, and he was transmitting QRP from home, but his reception was not good. So he was using a online web SDR receiver in Northern California, so not like the other side of the world, so kind of close to where he lived. But I thought that was a brilliant idea, because he had reasonable reception at this remote site that he could not get at home.
Well, that's cool.
So, yeah, I think it's a great idea. So, yeah, I think we'll see a lot more of that.
So, yeah, well, that's what has been the closest to my workbench.
Well, and still at some point we want to do that Autodesk. I forget the name of the – what's the mechanical – design tool.
Oh, yes, the designing the case for the mute button in Fusion 360, yes.
Fusion 360, yeah. So someday I want you to walk me through that. So we'll have to do a video
We'll do another live stream. This was my biggest mistake in the last one. There is a button you can push so that the software application will stay up while we're all talking, as opposed to it continuously switching cameras. So, hey, we're learning. But yeah, that is something that we do hope to do before the end of the year, is another Friday night live stream of walking through some of these tools.
Yeah, very good. So anything else on the bench?
No, not really meaningfully. I'm sitting here looking at my BitX, which is now going to become a probably a Thanksgiving weekend project.
Good. Very good.
But no, other than that, that's about it. What about you? What's on your workbench?
I have too much stuff on the workbench. I've got projects I haven't gotten to, but the ones that are really bubbling up, getting all of my attention right now. Number one is working on our next generation repeater control system. And we've been at this for quite some time. We're going on the third generation, and we've decided to go to a almost all surface mount board. Up to now, we've done 2-layer boards with through-hole parts because we could hand assemble them easily. And then once we get it working, then we'll go make a bunch. But you know, we really want to cram more stuff in a small space. So we decided to go to a 4-layer board and go all surface mount. So this is about the most compact or crowded board I've ever made. It's about 4.5 inches by 6 inches. And there's about, oh, I'd say 14, 15 integrated circuits on it, plus a whole bunch of passives and connectors. And it's pretty chock full. So all the signal traces are on the top and bottom, and the two middle traces are power and ground. So that does help the congestion a little bit, and also gives us some more ground plane for noise reduction. We ever had a problem with that, but what the heck. So this is bubbling up as the top project right now. And the guy who is developed it with me, John, KJ6K, is in high gear working on the firmware, and I need to get the new version of the boards done so we can actually build some of these things.
You know, we had the pleasure of meeting John at Dayton. I think my first time was that 2 Daytons ago?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a neat guy.
Oh, John's great.
He's John also is scary smart.
He is. You know, the trick is to surround yourself with smart people. So you know, and John's one of those guys. So we sort of joke about it a bit that he does the firmware and I do the hardware. And the hilarious thing is he's actually not a software guy. He's really a hardware guy, but he's doing the software. And I did all the architectural design on the hardware and then the circuit design. And anything I don't understand, I just go to John and say, would you please explain this to me? What should we do here? And he gives me a lengthy explanation that I almost understand. And then I usually respond and say, what value should the part be? Just give me an answer, please.
So if I remember correctly, did he not write a real-time operating system for, was it AppMegas?
No, it's for a PIC.
Of course it was.
Yeah. Well, he would cringe to say that it's a real-time operating system, but it's kind of in that vein. So when we started working on the repeater controller, it became really clear that we needed the master processor to seemingly do multiple things at the same time and not skip a beat. So how do you do that? It's really easy to write what's called blocking code. And blocking code means essentially you've got a big control loop and you do something, you do item one, then you do item two, then you do item three, then you do item four, and you do item five, and then you loop back to the top and do number one again. And that works great for a lot of applications. So like, for instance, if I'm going to read a voltage and then display it on a LCD panel, and I'm just going to constantly read a voltage and update the display, I could just do that in a big loop. And the software only does one thing at a time. It's either reading the voltage or writing the display. And for that application, that's okay. The problem with the repeater controller is that to get it to behave the way you want it to behave, the way you would expect it to behave, it has to seem like it's doing multiple things at the same time. So what would that be? So for instance, this controller handles up to 8 ports, meaning I can have 8 repeaters or links or voice over IP computers or whatever hooked up into this. And I could have any of those 8 ports talking to any other 8 ports in any configuration I want. And every one of those ports can be controlled with DTMF codes going into any of the receivers. And if, let's say, I'm transmitting into repeater port 1 and I'm entering a DTMF command, the controller has to not only decode that sequence of DTMF commands, but what if somebody comes in on a link port? Let's say port number 5 is a radio link, and someone enters on that port and also sends a command to the controller. Well, the controller needs to listen to that port simultaneously and handle both of these things at the same time and do a bunch of other stuff at the same time, like timers and tone generation and looking at the control serial port. Anyway.
Or my favorite, net tonight at 7 p.m.
Yeah, our telemetry sounds better than that, but yeah, that too. So all that stuff has to go on at the same time. So what you don't want is, you know, someone's entering a touch tone on the repeater, and because the controller is in a loop and it's listening to the tone decoder, you can no longer send commands to the UART, the serial port, or you can't generate tones going out another transmitter for telemetry. Well, that's not acceptable. So John had to write the core of the repeater controller software in a way that lets you do that. And the technique that you use is basically writing at the core of the controller a interrupt handler. And an interrupt handler is essentially a piece of code that will look for events, and when events happen, it'll task switch. It'll switch from one task to another task and seemingly do things simultaneously, when in fact, what it's really doing is it's doing a little bit of this thing and a little bit of that thing, then a little bit of this thing, then back to the first one. And it's kind of round robin between these multiple tasks, but it happens so fast that you don't realize it. So that is at the heart of what you would have in a little baby real-time operating system.
So it's like a more scheduling.
Probably the best name for such a thing is a real-time executive. It's a very simple task switching kernel. I wouldn't go so far as to call it a whole operating system, but that's essentially what it does. So while I'm decoding DTMF on port A and while I'm transmitting a tone on port B, I could be entering a command in the UART and everything seems to work. And so John developed that real-time exec, and it works awesome. I mean, it's awesome. And it's not an easy thing to do by any stretch of the imagination, but that's the sort of thing that you have to do if you're really doing like complicated real-time embedded stuff.
I don't remember if we talked about this. Are you guys going to continue with PIC, or are you looking at switching to the Atmel stuff?
We're going to stick with the PIC, mainly because if you look at PIC versus Atmel, it's like Ford and Chevy. So there's really not a big advantage of switching. We're using 8-bit PICs. So there's one master PIC that does the main system control. And then every board, which is a port of every one of those 1 to 8 ports, also has a PIC that does some stuff locally. And the PIC's perfectly fine. It's plenty fast enough to do all that. And we've got a lot of code. So there's sort of no motivation to switch. We did some years ago decide we wanted to add more features that you can't really do on a PIC very easily. And the way we handle that is we made a host adapter for a BeagleBone Black and a host adapter for a Raspberry Pi. So anything that you want to do with a more sophisticated programming environment, like Ethernet, network connectivity, voice telemetry, fancy scheduling of events is so much easier to do in Linux than it is in a PIC or an Atmel, that we have this option to plug in an embedded Linux board, and that adds those extra features to the system. So you can run in kind of the minimal configuration, which is everything runs off the real-time microcontroller, which is super-duper reliable. And if you want to add those fancier features, you can plug in the embedded Linux board. Now you got a ton more programmability.
You know, this isn't related at all, but you just reminded me of something.
What's that?
Well, sorry to go back to me, but this morning I was looking for something on my workbench before I left for work. And above on shelving above my workbench, as I mentioned in the past, I have two Raspberry Pi clusters, one made of Raspberry Pi 2s and one made of Raspberry Pi 3s. And it occurred to me, I haven't really looked at their performance in like in months at this point because you know, they're still contributing to Einstein at home. I'm not going to put any more effort into the Pi 2 cluster as nodes die. That's it. Because, I mean, I can't really USB boot them, so it's not worth me. I'm not investing in any more SD cards for it. I have the distinct privilege of being somebody who has now nuked, fully nuked, two Raspberry Pi 2s.
How'd you do that?
I looked up in the cluster because even if the thing falls over, the network light stays lit and the power lights stay lit. Two of my Pi 2s in my stack are dark and nothing will make them light up. I tried applying more power, unplugging and plugging back in, tried a different USB power supply, tried feeding 5 volts in over the pins. They're dead.
No kidding. And I wonder why.
Well, I mean, I ran them at full capacity, full tilt, full processing, I'd say for, what, about a year and a half now? Because the two that died were two of the very first ones I ever started doing this with. I can tell based on where they are in the stack. So they're two of the original four when I started this all early summer of last year. So I overbaked some pies.
Oh.
I actually think it's a badge of honor.
Well, I won't tell you about my story of burning up multiple BeagleBone Blacks because I wired them up backwards. But
I'm going to assume
that's something I don't admit to.
Well, I'm also assuming those were all first rev boards, just knowing your history.
Yeah, no. Well, see, long story short was I wanted to mount the BeagleBone upside down so it could plug on top of a host adapter. And so I dropped a footprint of a BeagleBone on the layout, and stupid me, I needed to flip the footprint upside down in order to get the pins the correct orientation. And if you don't do that, then you wire it up exactly backwards, and they turn into a big fuse.
Well, or it's a very short-term smoke machine.
It's fortunately nothing came out, but they did stop working completely. So I can verify that if you do power a BeagleBone backwards, you are pretty guaranteed that you're got a brick on your hands.
You know, we should start a website that's a collection of things that we've learned so other people don't have to.
Yeah, thing number one, don't plug the thing in backwards, okay? Anyway, so that's the summary on the a quick summary on the repeater controller. Maybe at some point we can talk about the design. I think it's a rather interesting approach because we had this hybrid between microcontrollers and embedded Linux boards, which could be used, you know, either or. And so that was sort of a fun thing to architect.
Well, I mean, quite frankly, the stuff you guys have done in Sierra Radio Systems are so large scale. You know, it's not like just it's way more than what the single repeater op would need.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, yes and no. So it is. So these repeater controllers are really designed for big linked systems. So if you've got, you know, one or two repeaters and three or four or five links and all that, this is exactly what that's designed for. And most repeater controllers don't do things that this does. So this is really kind of at the high end of the complexity spectrum. But, you know, if you're running a big network, you need this sort of stuff. So I'll give you one little example. With this controller, if you wanted to route, let's say, a repeater on port 1 to a link on port 3, while three links on port 2, 4, and 5 are hooked together, you can run subnets, essentially. Anything can go to anything. So it's an 8x8 cross-point matrix, which means you have to have, you know, a full 8x8 audio switching matrix. And then in the audio processing, we have multiple stages of amplification and filtering, and we take PL out of the circuit. Every The channel has its own tone decoder. Every channel can generate unique and different telemetry simultaneously, et cetera, et cetera. So there's kind of a lot to it, which makes them fairly expensive. But if you're building a big network, you need this kind of functionality. At least we think so.
Well, I'm gonna continue ribbing you about building the simple version for a single repeater.
Yeah. So and I think we're going to come back to do that. I've been wanting to do that for a long time, and I think we will. I actually have some related projects that I want to mention here in a moment. So one of the other projects that's related to this that's on my list is I want to build a all-star node. You know, we had this discussion on the digital repeaters and VoIP systems, and all-star was one of the topics, and I've been really wanting to do that. So I got some Baofeng UV-82s, and I figured out how to mod them to get to the right signals, which is really easy. And so I'm making some circuit boards that I could use to mount the UV-82 handy talkies to a little board and solder the important signals to the circuit board, and then have a way for those boards to interconnect. And then on a baseboard, put a Raspberry Pi that'll be the interface into the All-Star network. And while I'm at it, I think I'm going to put a microcontroller on there so you could alternatively use that stack as a little baby repeater.
Oh.
You know, so if you want to do a little VoIP hotspot or a little portable field day repeater or, you know, some sort of little baby event repeater. Now, using two Baofengs as a repeater is fraught with problems because there's no really good selectivity. The front end on the receiver will get pretty easily overloaded by the transmitter. But, you know, for very localized applications like around your house, it could be fine.
Or crossband if you...
Yeah. Crossband would certainly help. Although I find that irritating on the user side. So I'd probably just put a little mobile duplexer on there and go that route.
Yeah, well, so that would only work for UHF. I have not seen a mobile 2-meter duplexer.
Yeah, they make them, but the problem is the splits are too wide. So they're like 8 megs or 7 megs wide, and so that just doesn't work in the ham band. So exactly. They're just not available. So back to your point about making a simple repeater controller. So what I'm thinking about is there'd be a baseboard that has a microcontroller and a Raspberry Pi. And then those devices would talk to another board above it that would have one or two of these Baofengs mounted to it. If you only had one, then maybe it'd be a 3-stack with a second radio on the third elevation, if you follow me, a stack of 3 boards. And you can have that little baby repeater controller made out of the microcontroller, and maybe we just open source the code. Now, for something that simple, if you're really going like inexpensive, kind of bottom drawer, basic bare bones functionality, you wouldn't necessarily do all this real-time interrupt-driven stuff. You could write a very simple control algorithm in the PIC or Atmel that just uses a basic control loop, and you're going to give up some features. But, you know, for a really cheap, quick and dirty repeater controller, you don't really need that.
No, you don't. And I mean, and it's, if you do it the way you're talking about it, I mean, you could possibly even add the opportunity for people to extend things. I mean, it's the thing, right? You buy a repeater controller now. Yes, there's some, I'm assuming most of them have some form of GPIO to interface with other things, but I don't know. And I know not everybody owns a repeater, but I still think it could be a cool project to provide like the base hardware that's expandable, and like you said, the software is open source. And I think that'd be great. And I'm also selfishly, I'm still looking for a repeater controller for our club's repeater.
Well, for your club, we, you know, once we make more of the really good ones, then you need to get one of these.
Did I mention we,
you have no money?
We have no money. We don't have George money for Sierra Radio Systems.
Yeah, well, I have a really cool badge you guys made for me that I got at Dayton, so maybe we could do some kind of barter deal.
Yes, 50,000 badges. Badge.
Now you're talking.
You know, so, part of the spiel when we sell those things is we offer to upgrade people from general to extra for an extra $5.
And give them whatever call sign they want.
That's right. So if I haven't seen this, we do a badge that we print their FCC license on the back, and then in the front it's a photo with what operating class they are and their call sign, and then any endorsements from a select group of folks that we have permission to use their logos. But yeah, we always say go from general to extra for $5. We're kidding, of course.
Now, you could also say for $20, we'll take 20 pounds off and some gray. So,
yeah, you know, we also invented an operating class called Super Extra,
which is what?
Well, you get all the bandwidth then, ham or not. I don't know.
Yeah, those batches were really nice.
Well, thank you. We will awesome. Have them at Dayton again.
I'm looking forward to Dayton. We are going to be at Dayton.
Yes.
We'll be there again. So so that's kind of two big, somewhat related projects. My guess is that the main repeater controller project, the next rev of boards, I'm hoping to have early next year, like in March. So we're making the first version of the hardware now. I actually have a prototype board in front of me that it is fraught with errors, and so it's going to get tossed, and they quickly make the second prototype rev, and hopefully we'll get those in a couple weeks and start populating the boards and see what we find. And with any luck, it'll work.
We look forward to hearing more about that.
Yeah, indeed. And let's see, BayCon 2018, the Baynet Amateur Radio Club conference is coming up in January, and I mention that now for two reasons. One is, if anybody's in the Bay Area on January the 20th, Saturday, January the 20th, you're welcome to come check out BayCon in Sunnyvale, California, at the Plug and Play Tech Center, which is a startup incubator that kindly provides us with space for the event. And we have a whole bunch of great presentations lined up. So we've got folks talking about soda operation, talking about microwave radios, satellite weather receiver projects, running video over 5 gigs, leveraging your amateur radio license for some first-person video for drones. Let's see, what else? Building stuff like an all-star node. One of the guys is presenting, so I'm all excited about that. We got some great presentations coming up. So a lot of that stuff will be recorded, and we'll share that here on the podcast. So you can check that out at www.bay-net.org, and you can click the link and see what the program looks like.
You know what the only presentation anybody is really going to care about is?
What's that?
Antenna Analyzer V2.
Yeah, you know, the bummer is that Barrick is not going to be there. He was planning to do a whole presentation on low-cost RF test equipment, and it turns out he has a schedule conflict of all things, and he can't be there. So, but he did offer to come on the podcast and talk about that, talk about low-cost RF test equipment, part two.
Well, cool.
Yeah, so we'll definitely do that. So lots of things happening. One last thing I want to mention is a quick update on our build projects. We have two build projects in the hopper that we need to finish off. The power monitor that started out life as the low voltage disconnect that turned into the power monitor. We had a bunch of those at Dayton, and I've gotten several emails over the last few months of people politely saying, when am I going to get one? Or when can I get one? And I keep saying yes later. And the new design is pretty much done. I just need the time to make a fabbed board. You know, have the board made and stuff it and test it. So I think we're probably on track to get that thing done in the next month or two, and then we'll have details.
Yes, and overall, just to let folks know, is we have worked out a plan to restart our board distribution for next year. And, of course, the Antenna Analyzer V1, we will not be bringing those back if there was enough demand and folks were willing to source the ultra-rare germanium diodes themselves, that it might be worth discussing. But overall, we're looking forward to bringing some new projects on, like the low-voltage disconnect, the infamous George Smarty load.
And we still have some of those.
We do. Just not offered for sale yet. And then I think we're considering another one, are we not?
Yes. When we did our antenna shootout, we designed a circuit board that's a four-port antenna relay that you can either press a button on the board and switch the port, or you could use a serial port to command it. So I've got what I think is the final version of that done, and just got the circuit boards, and I need to populate it and test it. And Barrick's going to put it on the vector network analyzer and check it out and sweep it and see what it looks like. The results of the last one were good. This one will be slightly better, I think. And once we confirm that, then we'll probably make those boards available. So that particular one is using a PIC microcontroller. And for that, we'll probably make the boards available and a pre-programmed PIC, and you can get the rest of the parts on DigiKey. So yeah, I think we'll probably do that one too also by the end of the year.
Well, very good. Anything else? Yeah, I'm glad you have so much on your workbench since I have been slacking in that apartment for several weeks.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I have a lot of things in the hopper. Unfortunately, I can't get to all of them, but I'm hoping that between now and the end of the year, there'll be a few days of vacation time in there and maybe get some of these projects done.
All right. Well, with that, I say it's time to open the junk drawer.
Now, wait a minute. You got to set this up properly. We get some awesome interviews.
We do have some awesome. And again, the junk drawer is full of useful. The junk drawer is full of useful but mismatched things.
So in the next segment, we're going to hear from Step IR, Flex Radio, and Novexcom from Pacificon in beautiful San Ramon, California. Elecraft is one of my top picks for high-performance HF radios. They make fantastic base station-style radios, amplifiers, pan adapters, and other station accessories. They're also the designers of the KX3 and KX2, the ultimate portable HF radios. If you're thinking about SOTA, portable operating, or travel, you really need to be looking at Elecraft. Elecraft has some of the best designs in the industry, compact, high-performance, feature-rich designs. You're really going to love them. The KX2 is my personal favorite for going portable. It's ultra-small, 80 through 10 meters, sideband CW and data modes, and the thing runs 10 watts on the internal batteries. You'll love it. Check it out at elecraft.com. In this week's show, we have a special segment about the Mount Diablo Amateur Radio Club's annual Pacificon Ham Radio Conference, this year held in San Ramon, California. San Ramon is in Northern California in the San Francisco Bay Area, and Pacificon draws over 2,500 attendees every year. At Pacificon, I had a chance to talk with three of the vendors. We talked to our friend Mike Walker from Flex Radio. We talked with the folks from Stepper Antenna and the folks from Novexcom, who make really nice 19-inch rack mount cutouts, panels, shelves, and other hardware accessories to make a portable radio go box. The Mount Diablo Radio Club really does a fantastic job with the Pacificon event, and we hope you enjoy the interviews with these three vendors. So I'm here at Pacificon with Mike Walker, VA3MW, and we talked to Mike on the podcast a few episodes ago about remote radio operation, and we're sitting here in the Flex Radio booth. And as I walked up to see Mike and say hello, I noticed that he's standing in front of the maestro. So first of all, I want to say hi, Mike. Glad to hear you back again on the show.
And thanks, George. It's nice to see you again. It's been since Dayton, I think.
Yeah, it's been a while. And we had a lot of good response on the remote operating episode that we did together. So thanks very much for coming on to do that. And this maestro thing really caught my eye. And it's looks like a control head about a foot wide and about 8 inches tall with a beautiful color display and a bunch of knobs. So, Mike, why don't you tell us about what this thing is?
So the Maestro is one of our control panels for the 6000 series radios from Flex. And it can control two slices. And you had asked the question earlier, geez, what's a slice? And a slice is essentially two receivers that you can use at the same time. The Maestro gives the ability to sit this very... It's big. And we designed it to be big so you could see it easily. You can reach the buttons easily. You know, you don't need a magnifying glass to find where things are. And you sit it on your desk, and it's got bendy feet. If you upgrade it to the bendy feet, you can tilt it up and down and see it from a lot of different angles. Minimal amount of buttons on the front panel, volumes, AGCT, which is our most powerful tuning control that's like an RF gain, but it's the one that really optimizes the SDR and how it operates by the automatic gain control threshold. And that's key. That's my most powerful tool. Your filter bandwidths, and of course, two big VFO knobs that have some beautiful weight. You tried them. You thought they spun them. They spun just like, you know, and they had some inertia to them. They're really cool.
Feels like a real radio.
Feels like a real radio.
So when I first see this thing, I think it looks like a control head. Does it have a radio in it, or does this front end an RF deck that's a separate radio?
No, this is just the control head. There's no RF hardware in it. It connects by wired or wireless to your radio on your basic home network. Works fairly well. It also can be a SmartLink front end, and SmartLink is our remote control. You know, you can take it to a Starbucks and plug it in, and if their internet's good enough, and that's a bit of a caveat, you could sit there and operate.
So the edge of this is really an IP connection. So it's a Wi-Fi IP connection. So you literally could hop onto the Starbucks Wi-Fi and use it.
You'd be a little geeky, but you know, maybe in the Valley here that would look normal. But yeah,
that would look totally normal at a Starbucks in the Valley.
And people have done that. So that's it gives you control over all of our 6,000 radios, starting with the 6,300, 6,500, 6,700, 6,400, and 6,600 in the order they came out with. And then we also have taken this one step further on our new radios, where it looks like we've taken the Maestro and glued it to the front of a box. And we have. And that's for all of us that have been on HF for 100 years and growing up, where we've plopped the radio down at a table or field day, plugged up some power, hooked up an antenna, plugged in a microphone, and you're immediately on the air. No computer required at all. But in fact, also, you can take the Maestro and hook it up to any of the 6,000 radios, and you're just on the air. You do not need a computer interface at all.
So when I think about Flex radios from when I first saw them, I think about them as a box, and then the computer is the user interface with all of the graphical display and all that stuff. So you really, I guess now you really have the range from that sort of black box computer user interface to a completely standalone integrated box conventional looking radio to the ability to split the control head from the RF deck, right?
Right. And we've tried to make this as simple as possible. We've gotten over the hump now of the early adopters in the power SDR world, where you can hack it together, make it work, and it's really cool. But now we're getting into the operators that just want it to work, okay? And that's where we're at now. You can open the box, plug it in, hook up a LAN cable, and if your radio's there, you can actually just plug it right into the radio. You don't need like all the other internet stuff, and it will just talk to the radio. In fact, that's how we do that in a couple of places here in the shop or in the display, is it's just a simple LAN cable talking to the black box. You just happen to be able to put it closer to the antennas, or it doesn't have to be dead square in front of you, the RF deck anymore. It can be over there.
So when I like that, because when I think like in my radio operating position at home, I have a computer table and there's a shelf on top of the table, and that shelf is about 10 inches deep. So there's very few radios you could sit there and not have them hanging off the back or poking out the front. And so with this as the control head, you could put the RF deck anywhere in the shack or in the house, right?
Yeah, or the breakfast table or the dining room or the...
Or just take it with you.
Or the deck.
So when you look at the Maestro, I can see where that would be one thing you would buy. Could you describe the different RF back end, the RF decks? I guess there's a different price performance range that you offer.
Right. And I'll talk about the two new models. They're the 6400 and the 6600. Both of those are fairly similar. The 6400 has two slices available and bandpass filters that are third-order bandpass filters that eliminates or helps reduce co-band interference. If we jump up to the 6600, it's essentially two of those radios. We have two spectral capture units. The other's a good buzzword, but that allows you to listen to different things on different antennas at the same time. And we can run four slices or four receivers and go, what do I need four receivers for? And without fail, everybody we sell one to that says, I need more than four, because they'll be monitoring 6 meters. They'll be running FT8 and JT65 monitoring at the same time on two different bands, you know, because they're waiting for a band opening. If you're a contester, you're parked a visual display up on 10. I would have thought I never would have used more than two, but yeah, I've used four a couple of times. And then the one more step, on both of those two models, the 64 and the 66 that we announced at Dayton, and we will be shipping those next month, we have the M model, which is where we take the Maestro and it's part of the same box.
Okay, so if you were getting into this, let's say you're going to start at the bottom end. You don't want to underbuy, but you bought the basic, let's say the lower end RF deck and the Maestro user interface. About how much are we talking about for that combination?
So the 6400 is $19.99. And for the, if I put my ham hat on for a while, I got a pretty good gut feel that, you know, for that price, I'm getting a really good front end and a really good RF deck for $2,000. Maestro's $11.99, and it will work with any one of our 6000 series radios. Beyond even the Maestro, if I may, you can also use a PC. There's a Mac client available from Dog Park Software to talk to the radios. You can use an iPad, an iPhone, and then we've got some pretty cool remote ability to just, because I am at Starbucks and I just want to get on because I heard the VU's on and I want to work them, I can do it.
Work that rare DX.
That's right, yeah.
So it sounds like you can start out for $2,000 with a computer control or about $3,000 for a control head conventional radio feel with essentially two complete receivers in that one chassis.
That is correct. And the Maestro is cool. You didn't see the back of it as well, but you can hook up multiple different microphones to the back. So
let's take a look. Let's see what's on the back here. So we're actually flipping this thing over, and it looks like there's an RJ45... Ethernet connector and a power connector, then a whole mess of general purpose connections. Tell us what you got there.
So you can plug in a CW key, either straight key or a set of paddles on the top. You can feed the output to powered speakers. Good computer speakers are good. I'm sure Bob Heil's got some cool ones he'd like you to use as well. Just a line out if you wanted to run that into a computer. Your headphones, of course. A push-to-talk feed. Mic 2 is a, looks like a, and these are all, by the way, 1/8 inch tip ring sleeve. Mic 2 for a basic computer set of headphones or and microphone, like a COS SB40 or something like that. There's also a push-to-talk lead on that you can turn off or disable or enable. Another line in if you were coming in from a mixer. And your standard RG45 for a basic ham mic.
So it looks like you have everything you need. I noticed, like, when I was setting up my station, I have a mic on a boom, and that's connected, but I really want that connected on the back, not the front of the radio. So this way you, right, exactly. So you can do it nice and neat with all the cabling on the back. You don't have stuff hanging off the front. Right.
And George, did you notice these four holes?
It looks like a Visa mount.
It's a Visa mount, so you could put it on an arm.
Oh, very nice. Very nice. So that's, it's really beautiful. I got to tell you, like I said before, when I first saw it, I was surprised how big it was. Because when I looked at the pictures in the ad, I thought it was about 2/3 that size. But the screen is really bright. What's the diameter or the diagonal measure of that?
9 inches, I think.
Okay. And so what we're seeing on the screen, I'll point the microphone at the screen so you guys can hear it. Well, actually, what it looks like is the top quarter, it has a numerical display showing frequency and meters and so forth. The bottom 2/3, there's a couple of different windows showing either a spectrum display or waterfall or multiple spectral displays. Looks like the refresh rate's pretty fast on the spectral display as well.
Correct. And if you're remote, because bandwidth, as we talked about in my remote operating, my upload bandwidth, because I'm now the server, I'm now my own version of Netflix, is very restricted. I have about a megabit upload. So even on the refresh rate on the waterfall and the pan adapter, you can vary to really slow if you want, just in order to save your bandwidth.
Okay, so what Mike's doing is he's touching the screen, and normally the screen is showing the waterfall, the spectral display, and frequency and so forth, but just touching the screen brings up a bunch of menus, and so you can select very easily from the menus what the data refresh rate is. So that just reduced the amount of bandwidth you need on the internet. So most people have DSL or cable, and even today the crummiest DSL is still a megabit. So at this refresh rate we're looking at here, what would you need to make that work?
We'd be hovering about a megabit, but we'd also want to really look at our latencies and our buffer float numbers. So you may become a bit more of an expert in uploading data if you're sitting about a megabit or two upload. But for, you know, here in the Valley, I mean, you guys pay nothing for, and you get the stuff in Canada we only dream about.
Oh, yeah, no problem. You'd be surprised, actually.
So, yeah, well, I can't get fiber to my door either. But, and the other thing, of course, but it does give you the option. You can totally max it out. If you find your audio is breaking up a bit, you can say, okay, I need to hear them better than I need to look at the waterfall. I can dial it off and down.
Well, the user interface looks pretty simple, too. So you just hit the menu button, and then there's a bunch of sub-menus, and you select what network is a whole other window by itself, and you can adjust all those parameters.
You can program your we have three function keys that have multiple levels of shift, so you can then program the stuff you use all the time that maybe we didn't put on the front panel for you, from changing filter bandwidths to changing bands to CW keys, your modes.
So one of the things you mentioned before was for a station where you have other devices that you need to control with a PC, like a step IR antenna controller or a band decoder or some other accessory, normally that's a bunch of software and interfaces on a PC. So you were mentioning to me that there's a way to integrate that more easily into these radios.
Right. On the 6000 series, you can plug in an RS-232 USB adapter, the ones you can buy anywhere. We just ask that you use the FTDI ones, and we all know about prolific versus FTDI. From there, you can have your stepper driven directly from the radio. You can have your KPA 500, your expert linear, or most things that talk Kenwood CAT commands right off the radio, so we can correctly frequency track without having to have some software stuck in the middle. Same is also true. There's also BCD data, band control data, if you're the microwave guys have, where they're running a lot of transmitters and stuff, are always flipping a whole bunch of logic, so they make use of that as well. This just makes the simplicity of remote operating a lot more stable, or even any operating. If you're a contester, you know what it's like at 3 in the morning on Saturday after you've been up for a day and you do a band change and the amplifier trips off. Then you got to figure out why. That doesn't happen anymore because it just tracks like one big radio, one big station, and you do it. You don't have to go double check to say, if I go from 160 to 40, I got to remember to manually flip the switch. You don't.
So looking at the radios, one thing that kind of strikes me is I used to think about these radios, the Flex radios, as very full-featured, high-performance radios that take some expert user kind of knowledge how to use the radios. But I'm kind of surprised, frankly, how straightforward the UI is.
Right. We've called it, it's just simple now. We've gotten to the point where it's, amateur consumer level, without taking anything away from all hams. But we have a lot of customers or hams even today, as we've gotten on in our years. I don't have time to play with it. I just want to talk on it. I've paid my dues. So we've made it very simple. But we still have made the flexibility of, for somebody who wants to get under the covers, or they're running, they're pushing the envelope, those tools or toys are still there. And if you really want to exploit it because you're still a coder, we have a ton of APIs available that allow you to fully control the RF deck as well. And you can build your own version.
So my last question is, when we were talking on the podcast about operating remote from your station, what were you using? Remind us of what that was. Describe what your setup is.
So for my remote station in north of Toronto, because I'm a Canadian, I use the Maestro. I connect over, I happen to use a VPN still to connect to my remote station and my radio, which is 100 miles away, 160 kilometers from my Canadian friends. And then at the far end, I actually keep a PC where that has a bit special of integration. And I found that leaving the PC at the far end, while maybe a little risky, because what happens if I have to reboot it? Well, I've taken care of all those issues. But I could be anywhere in the world now. I could be here, home, a train. I just have to, if I have an internet pipe, I remote desktop connect to it, and it's just like sitting there. And that's how I've been advising people this weekend who are starting to get into, a good example yesterday, a gentleman comes up, bought a great house, he lives near here, put the tower up, had everything improved, neighbors all ganged up on it, and he had to take it all down. So he said, the heck with that. And he went and bought some property 25 miles away. It was a rental property. It was a good deal. It worked out great for him. It's got good internet and good HF. Those are sometimes mutually exclusive. And he was saying, what's the best way to hit this? And I asked him, you're okay if it was all sitting in front of you? He goes, yeah. Do it that way again, except now just make a remote connection to that computer. And if you're really stuck, you're a half hour away. You could drive over and fix something. And you will for the first year or two.
So simply put, he's sitting at home with the Maestro on the desk, and his RF deck is at the remote site, and there's just the internet in between. And the experience that the user has, that he has, operating the radio is as if it's all local.
It's all local. I want to show you a screen I didn't show you earlier, George, and I think we can do it here. So we're gonna disconnect from the display network here. And it's going to pop up a screen right now, and you're going to see half a dozen stations that we could connect to immediately. that are... You see the grin that just came over George's face?
This is cool. So, okay, so on the screen, there's a bunch of little radio icons, and it's listing like the Pacificon demo machine, Round Rock, Texas, Austin, Texas, Holly Springs, North Carolina. What are all these stations we're looking at?
So this is a client-server situation now. So I can now click Austin, Texas, and connect to this gentleman's screen, or you know, Steve N5AC is our VP of software. I can connect to his box and be on his station right away.
So this could be like your five buddies who also have Flex radios, and you could each have your own client set up, and you could each have your own stations set up at home or somewhere else, or maybe somebody doesn't have a station, but you can share those stations easily, I guess, remotely.
So there's two parts to that. So A, you have a shut-in. You have a buddy who's now gone to a home, but he still wants to get on 80 meters a night. You can walk over with your maestro. He can sit there and kibitz with his old buddies about how the world should be improved, which is cool. More important, or not even equally importantly, I want to do a 160-meter contest on my own. I don't have a 160 set up, but my buddy does, and he's not using it that weekend. I don't have to drive over to his place because it's three states away. I could just log into it.
So it seems to me like this is very much the direction things are going to go. I mean, for one thing, the core SDR technology clearly is kind of the direction for the future for a lot of reasons. But I think this ease of remote operation is going to be very appealing to a lot of us because many of us live in HOA-restricted areas. Maybe we have property out in the boonies, or maybe we all have a friend in Canada who has a place far away. Hey, by the way, if I get a maestro,
I'll let you use it.
Can I use your remote station?
Yeah, no problem. You just have to sign /VE3. So legally, I look at it, and it's different everywhere, but it's a long microphone cord. You can't log into, you know, somebody's station in Greece as a VE3 and then work somebody and claim it like it was DX. That's not really even morally right. But because this is my station or anybody else's remote station, or I was a guest operator, that's how you treat it. Your entity controls, you know, from where the transmitter sits. So it's a VE3 Ontario station or Texas or whatever. Don't expect you can exploit it to your ability to get, you know.
So simple question. If I have, let's say I have my station and my maestro, you have yours, and I want to allow you to use my station remotely, is there some like button I press that then releases my local user interface to allow a remote connection, or is it first come, first serve, or how does that work?
So there's two things at the moment. We're not really set up to do this in a real proper business way where you could have people share your station. The way you do it now is you just share your user ID and log in, which is, I guess, pretty much what everybody does anyway. But if I come along and George fell asleep, you know, and I want to take control of my station, I can just pull it from him, and okay. He drops off.
Okay, so the where you are physically located, you have control over that station.
So we see right here, you see the red that says in use?
Yeah.
So if I punch that now, it actually yank the carpet out from underneath him. But when you think of it, you know, we did design this to be single user, so it's like what happens all the time. I go somewhere, and I left my maestro connected at home. I don't want to have to call my wife to teach her how to use a maestro. I just want to yank control because we did set it up to be just for one person. But
so I can see there's sort of two modes in the future. One mode is I'm a super user and I would have access to this set of remote stations, and anybody else in my group would have access to that set of stations, and whoever takes control just gets control. If in the second mode where maybe you have a station where people who are not your friends that you give access to it, but you want to like be able to reserve or block or whatever, that's a whole other layer of management that, which that's we're not at that point.
We're not at that, you know, time limit. Maybe you want to give it to an SWL as a receive only mode. You've got licensing limits. Rhea, you've heard us mention Rhea before. She's let new hams who are thinking to go down this access to her unit. We do would be nice to have a transmitter lockout. And there's, you have to consider if George took control of my station in Canada, that he has to observe the licensing restrictions for him as a visitor type of thing. So you got to keep that in mind.
So if I operated your station remotely, legally, since there's reciprocal licensing between the U.S. and Canada, I would identify with my call /VE3.
Right.
And would I be operating under the band restrictions of a Canadian licensee then, right?
So let's use 40 meters as a good example, right? So as I understand it, and I'm probably the worst to explain it, but you can't go below 7125 or something on sideband?
That's right.
Whereas we can go all the way down to the bottom if we want. Now, we don't. We generally stop about 7050, but if you were driving around mobile or some station, you could, as your call slash VE3, operate on 7050 on sideband, because if you're allowed on HF at certain power levels. So it gets a little convoluted, and I'm sure we got some ham lawyers out there that can straighten us out. But
So if I'm an extra class licensee in the U.S., I can't operate voice on 40 below 7125, but in Canada you can. So in theory, I could work European stations below 7125 on sideband.
Correct.
Oh, okay. Well, that one more reason to do this. This is very cool. Mike, I want to thank you so much for the time. This has been really fun. And unfortunately, this has been a rather expensive experience for me, because now I want to get one of these things. So for a starter, you would start with the Maestro and which model of radio?
Probably the 6400. Occasionally we get refurbished certified pre-owned 6300s as well. And great entry at about $1,600, $1,699 to get in. And the Maestro will still work. And if it's really a budget issue, and, you know, I'm like you, I'm on a budget from day to day. Sometimes I can't have exactly what I want. So the radio still works out of the box with a Windows PC. You can just use the, you know, if George looks to his right, he'll see a big 26-inch monitor with a bigger version of the same thing.
So when I say the lower end, I was looking at the Sherwood receiver performance statistics, and it seems like all of the Flex radios are really up in the top. I mean, they're really amongst the very best radios from what I've seen in the receiver performance measurements, right?
Correct. And I'm glad you brought that up. Back in April, Rob reported that our 6300 had bad IMD numbers. In a previous world, if it was some other vendor, it was hardware-based, you'd have to send it home to get it fixed. We actually fixed that in a software patch. I believe Gerald told me roughly the improvement was a 15 to 20 dB IMD improvement that we fixed for free.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, that's awesome. So, and of course, it helps us keep our prices down, because all of this costs money. We have people that have kids that want to go through college and stuff. And anywhere we can be more efficient, we can present it at a better price point.
Well, that's excellent. Thanks a lot, Mike. Appreciate the time, and we'll get you back on soon.
Thanks very much, George. Have a good day.
So I'm at Pacificon with Bob, Whiskey Bravo 6 Sierra Lima Charlie, and Bob's company is called Novexcom, and I walked by the booth and I saw his beautiful racks of equipment, so I had to stop by and check it out and talk to Bob. Hi, Bob. How are you doing?
Good morning. Great to be here.
Well, we're really glad to stop by and look at your stuff. I'd love to own all of the racks of equipment that you're showing here in the booth. So tell us a bit about what you do.
We build the shack in the box. We'll help you take it with you. Hams have all their stuff in their shack. Nice. But when you decide you want to carry it with you, what we do is we'll help you pack it up and take it away. We build things like the shack in the box, which is one of our domains and trademarks. And we add to that whatever type of radio your license will carry or whatever you can manually carry. We build anything from 3U all the way up to 16 rack units of vertical mounting space. You can add any kind of radio you like to that. We support all brands of all manufacturers. The rack mounting industry is always one day behind the radio manufacturers. We tell people whatever they build today, we rack mount tomorrow. They come in very common sizes of 1U, 1¾ inches, 2U, 3½ inches, and in multiples of 1¾ inches, we can do any size you want, and it fits your standard rack rails, bolts right in.
So when I look at the gear, the cases are, they look like they're plastic, like a durable plastic 19-inch rack mount. They're injection molded cases with aluminum frames, and they're 19-inch rack mount screw-in panels, right?
Yeah, that's correct. You bolt them in typically with 4 bolts. In some cases, if it's very heavy, might be 6. But on average, it's usually 4 bolts, which is plenty to hold it in. Then you stack up a rack any way you like.
So looking at the units here on display, there's one that's about, what,
This particular entire rack mounting is 8 rack units. It consists of a 1 rack unit and a 3 rack unit here and a 3 rack unit here.
Okay, so what we're looking at here, this particular unit has a big sticker at the bottom that says ICOM America on it. Is this ICOM's demo rack?
This happens to belong to N9JA, Ray Novak. Ray sent us a big crate full of radios with a note. It said, figure it out.
Okay, so as I'm looking at this thing, the bottom couple U panel has a ICOM 7300 on the left side and a 5100 control head on the right side, and the face of the radios are pretty much flush or slightly poking out from the rack panel themselves. And then above that, there's another panel that's got, looks like a ICOM 2730 2-meter 440 radio, a commercial two-way radio, and some network equipment or something over on the left-hand side. And then at the top, there's a big cutout that says on the air with looks like a clock and a temperature display here.
Yeah, the clock modules, we call them a clock module, but that's a misnomer. They have a lot of firmware in them we got to design. What they do is they will scroll. You'll notice at this point it'll say 13.6 volts. And then if you watch it, it'll give you the time. It can scroll, or you can make it stand still. And it'll also show your, and it'll happen about any time now, it'll show the voltage, the temperature of your final amplifier if you want to put the thermistor tape to the final.
Okay, very good. So it looks like you'll make a custom case. I'm assuming that you can do a custom cutout for anything if we give you the dimensions, right?
That's correct. You tell us what you want. It might turn out to look like the one down here.
Okay, let's go take a look at what's down here. Okay, in the middle here, tell us what we're looking at.
This belongs to Peter Von Hagen, WA6HXM. I stole his case. Peter ordered the radio. He's got an FTDX 3000. It's a pretty healthy radio. We put it in a four-rack unit case. Four rack units is 7.0 inches by definition. We built one contiguous panel like this instead of a separated panel, so it's not a three and a one, it's a four. By doing that, we were able to scavenge a few more millimeters out of the middle. We got his dual clocks, we get his call sign, and you get your choice of red, green, or blue on the diffuser behind your call sign. So this is laser stenciled, exactly the way you need it.
So when you look at the radio is slightly offset to the right because there's room for a speaker that pokes out through the panel next to the radio. So everything is accessible off the front, including the microphone jack on the radio, and that clips on the front of the box. How deep are these boxes?
The boxes that we build are 16-inch deep with 13-inch rack trays. This allows you room in there to pack cables. In this case, there's a door on the back, and inside is hidden your big manual on how to operate your rig and your power cord, your microphones and some cables, maybe a key, a logbook.
Okay, so let's take a look at the back. Now I'm really intrigued what the front's beautiful. It's very clean and professional, but I'd like to see what the back looks like. So the back is about as clean as the front. So there's panels mounted to the back. Tell us about what we're looking at.
This happens to be a cute little one we build called a canned ham. This supports one radio. It's an all-band rig. I happen to pick the Yaesu FT-857. You can see a 30-amp power supply hidden in here. And there's room in here. There's about 3 inches of space to pack your other stuff, like a power cord or an antenna cable. On the back, you have your I.O. bar, which gets your AC in, your antennas in and out. And there's a row of them across this ICOM case. This is a demonstration case, so it has more stuff. In this particular one, we put a door on the back so Ray could access for wiring. And as you can see, there's a lot of wire in here. It used a lot of current. We had two 30-amp power supplies in here. You can see the radios very carefully stacked, packed in there in the rack, and you get a lot of stuff inside.
So in case of Ray's case here for ICOM, the back has about half of the vertical elevation are screwed in place rack panels with apron connections here for AC power, coax connectors, ground, etc. And then about half of it is a hinged door. So when the door is closed, the thing is very clean and professional. So the back looks as nice as the front, or you can open that door and get to all the wiring.
Right. We do the same thing for anybody else who needs it. We did that for Peter on this one. He has a three-rack unit door and his I.O. bar, AC power in, and in this case we put a cell phone charging jack. Hey, we all own a cell phone.
Okay, so if you want a turnkey box, we could just say, hey, Bob, I've got these two radios. I need a power supply. Cut all the panels and put a whole unit together for me, right?
That's correct. We can add your call sign, clocks, charging jacks, anything you want.
And if someone wants to put their own together or they just need a few parts, like they want a back panel or they want just the radio cut out, would you sell those pieces individually?
We'll sell you the car or we'll sell you the parts.
Okay, that sounds good. So what are some of the panels that you have that are standard panels?
Standard panels, we have a lot of off-the-rack stuff, so to speak. Some of them are like the little canned ham box, which is a stock item. And you can get that with like the ICOM 7100, which is an all-band rig. You can also get pieces over here, like speaker panels. We make 2, 3, 4, and 6 speaker panels in 2U and 3U size. We also have some stock items like our, this is a on-the-air bar. You add 12 volts, and it lights up with on-the-air. You can key it. And it also has the dual clocks, which are also the triple function. So you can buy these off our website for $110.
Oh, very nice. So it looks like if you're doing a portable station, this is great. If you have a fixed station and you have rack rails and you want to mount your gear in a desk or in a rack rail, then this would be a good way to do that.
Exactly. It started out 15 years ago. And it was designed for fixed rack station, and then it's morphed into the shack-in-the-box concept.
So one last question. How do you mount the radios inside? I assume that behind the panel there's a shelf or something that's supporting the radio, and there's some way to connect the radio to that shelf mechanically.
Inside of each of these is a rack shelf or tray. We'll call it typically a tray. And you bolt your radio down to that, especially for portable use. And you take your mobile mounting bracket, if it came with it. A lot of times you'll go out and you'll buy a used radio. You go out to the swap meet or an auction website. You'll buy a used radio. It didn't come with a mounting bracket. We will make you custom mounting brackets for it because when you're carrying it around, you need to bolt those radios down and stabilize them. If you're using it in the shack, it's not so difficult. You can set it down, put a hold-down strap. They mount easily.
Okay, so last question. So here's a sample project. I'd like to get an idea for the cost for something like this. So a bunch of buddies have bought the ICOM 7300 because it's a really nice radio at the price point with a beautiful display. And looking at some of these examples here, it seems like a case that would fit the 7300 and a speaker and then have some of the back panels. That would be a really nice setup here. So that would be about, what, a 3U tall case?
That would be a 3U. You're probably looking at right in the area with a case, with the 7300 panel, power supply, magnetic mic clip, speaker, pretty much wired, ready to go. You add radio, an I.O. bar on the back. The 7300 has 2 antenna jacks on it for HF and 6 meters. So we put 2 bulkhead UHF connectors on the rear, an IEC for AC power in. You're out the door basically at around $575, $580.
Okay, and so for $500, you have a very professional installation, and it would really protect your gear.
Ready to go, out the door, and you can put the covers on it, put your logbook inside of it, and drive away and go up to a hilltop or an ARES function or a field day.
And I notice on this unit here, it looks like there's a little light bar protruding out the front. Is that what this is?
We make LED light bars. We have these custom built. They're 18 inches wide, which is all you can get on the panel. It comes with a pulse width modulation electronic dimmer, and you can turn it on, set it to any light level you want. It's 110 degree dispersion straight down onto your work surface. It's not in your eyes. Comes in either white, red, or blue. Red being the most common because it's best for your eyes. I think it was Eastman Kodak proved that about 120 years ago in developing film, for those old enough to remember film. And so this will point downward because your radios are back illuminated, but they don't show you where the knobs are.
Okay, so I do have one last question. So let's go back to the 7300. So I'm looking at Ray's case here. And he has the 7300 on the left and the 5100 VHF UHF D-Star radio on the right. And it looks awesome. If I wanted that panel with those two cutouts for those radios, in the smallest case. The only thing I'm really missing is space for the speaker. So what size of case would you pick in order to fit a speaker in with those two radios?
You're going to be into at least an area of 4 rack to perhaps 6 rack units. Now, this is an 8U case here, but it depends on where you want to go with it. Now, iCompact, they've got 4 radios in here, but one of the radios, the 7300, has dual receive capability. So we put a row of speaker jacks on the front. We built for them a 4-speaker panel and the 4 jacks, and we bolt it on the back or stick it inside. You open the case, you set your 4-speaker panel on the top of the of here or on the sides, and you plug them in the front, and that gives you multiple speakers for your left and right channels and on your VHF, UHF, D-Star radio, and, whatever you have.
Wow, that sounds awesome. So this is beautiful stuff. Thank you so much. It's very nice to meet you, and I hope you do well here at Pacificon.
Thank you.
At Pacificon, we're talking to Bart K7HAZ, who's the business manager for Step IR Antennas. Hi, Bart.
Hi, George. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. And we talked about one of your new products on the show a couple episodes ago, and it's the new Urban Beam. And that caught a lot of our attention because normally a lot of us look at the stepper antennas and think, that would be awesome. I'd love to have one of those big Yagi antennas. But we live in an urban setting, and we can't put up a big tower or can't put up a big Yagi. But the urban antenna seems like an interesting alternative. So tell us a little bit about that antenna.
Well, great. And yes, the Urban Beam was designed with the intention of being something that allows people on, you know, city lots or urban lots to get a 40 through 6 meter continuous coverage antenna that fits into a little bit smaller space. The antenna itself is a kind of a modified two-element beam. It's two elements on 20 through 6 meters and a 40-meter rotatable dipole on both 40 and 30 meters. It's a little bit smaller than our standard two-element design in that it's about 30 feet tip-to-tip on it, whereas our old two-element with the 40-meter loop was actually 36 feet tip-to-tip. It's also a little bit smaller boom. It's a 48-inch boom rather than a 57-inch boom that was on our original two.
So it looks like a little bit of a bow tie where the center is a little bit closer in than the ends from what I recall looking at the picture.
Absolutely. In fact, the original design name for it was going to be the Bowtie IR.
Oh, very good. Well, how about that? Excellent marketing. All right. So the thing that caught my eye about this is I'm sort of the typical urban residential lot owner. So I have a house in South San Jose, and the lot is relatively small, and I have a 4-band trap vertical antenna. And, you know, it's fine. It's easy to put up. It works okay. It's vertically polarized, obviously, so it's a little bit on the noisy side. When I think about putting up a horizontal antenna, I don't have two ends to drape a big dipole. So when I saw your antenna, I thought, well, I might be able to put that on the roof of my house, and it doesn't look enormous. So what are the advantages of an antenna like this, let's say, over my vertical?
Well, you touched on the first thing is you get away from the vertical polarization, which eliminates a lot of the noise that you're picking up from being in a neighborhood. I run a vertical at home just because that's all I've had the time to put up over the last many years. One of the urban beams is probably going to be going up at my house within the next few months. It doesn't take a lot of space, doesn't take a lot of tower or a lot of rotator to be able to do this. The first several units of these that we shipped since the introduction have, in fact, gone on some of the various rooftop towers that are available. So they're sitting at anywhere from 8 to 12 feet above the roof line on a typical residential home. That puts your maximum height of the antenna typically at about 24 to 32 feet above ground. And the performance has been outstanding. At 32 feet, mathematically, you're a little bit low for 40 meters. But with our design, you're actually able to tune it in and out a little bit to eliminate some of that ground loss.
So when you think about mounting an antenna like this, what's the weight or the wind loading? Can I bolt? I don't need a number, but I'm just thinking, like, do I need a conventional tower, like a big Rhone thing to mount this to? Or can I bolt a piece of EMT metal tubing to my chimney and clamp this thing to the top?
Legally, I'm not going to say yes to that, but can you do it? Absolutely. In fact, I know a couple of them. Guys have just put them up on heavy tubes, and they have a little clamp on the bottom that allows them to rotate it through the clamps that they bolted to the side of their house. We're hams at heart. We do all sorts of crazy inventive things, and, you know, it's a lot of fun to be part of that.
Okay, so the antenna, let's say on my house, I've got a chimney on the top. I could clamp a mast to the chimney, bolt the antenna to the top of that. It's two-story, so I'm, you know, 20-plus feet off the ground. That sounds like a good start. I don't have to put up a big tower. So besides clamping the antenna to the mast, what other hardware do I need to make it work?
You would need control cable. And you order that by the foot from our company. It's just a 12-conductor shielded cable. Beyond that, the basic parts of the antenna that you have to have to operate are included as part of the package. So all of our antennas, all of our motorized antennas, I should say, ship with an SDA 100 controller. That comes factory configured for your antenna. Once you get the antenna up in the air, you'll go through a couple of just minor setup things and push a button for the band that you want to be on and get on the air.
Okay, so this SDA 100 thing, that's a little box. It's the control box for the antenna. So for people who don't know what the guts of a stepper antenna are like, not just the urban Yagi, but the other stepper Yagis, could you describe what's unique about the stepper antennas and how they work?
Boy. So the unique thing about the stepper antenna design is that it's a dynamic antenna where we use motors inside the elements to actually physically change the length of the tapes that are the radiating elements or the parasitic elements. By creating an antenna that adjusts to the correct length for every band and every frequency, you come up with an antenna that is a lot more efficient. It also eliminates the need to use an antenna tuner, which is, of course, a loss point for your output.
So that makes sense. So if there's, I guess, two motors on this antenna, one for the driven element and one for the reflector. Is it a reflector-driven element or a director-driven element?
So with our antenna design, you can actually have it be set up as either one. It depends on if you're in the normal mode or in the 180 mode.
So when I first looked at this antenna, what I noticed is it's a big continuous tube, and there's, I guess, two sets of the tape elements and two motors. Is that right?
That is correct. So what we do is we have on the passive side, which can be either the director or the reflector, depending on what configuration you're in, that's set up just for use when you're on any of the bands between 20 and 6 meters. The 40-30 element goes around the bow tie or the sweep at the end of the element and starts coming back towards the boom on the other side, and that's what gives you the length for the rotatable dipole for 40 and 30 meters.
Okay, so the other element is completely retracted, and the driven element, the dipole, essentially goes around the corners and comes back.
Basically, yes. Yep.
So when I think about putting up a 40-meter antenna, I've got this four-band vertical, and most of my activity is on 20 and 40. And on 40 meters in the evening, I can hear everybody's television and every electronic device in the neighborhood. So I'm hoping that going to a horizontally polarized antenna like this would be better. So would I notice a difference in the noise level?
You should definitely notice a difference in the noise level just because you're getting away from the vertical polarization. Depending on how high you install the antenna, you may also be able to get a little bit above it as well.
So if you're on the 40 or 30 meter configuration and you rotate the antenna, do you notice any directionality as a dipole? There should be, in theory, a tiny bit, but do you notice any difference?
You do indeed. You know, and that's one of the advantages of having a dipole that's not just static wire dipole between two trees, is you can rotate it and take advantage of a little bit of directionality with it.
Okay, great. And one last question. If I'm switching bands, let's say I'm going from 40 to 10 meters, a big change, do I just listen on the other band with the antenna in the last configuration, or do all the elements have to move to the proper position? So is band switching quick with this kind of an antenna?
Band switching is fairly quick, but if you're going from 6 meters to 40 meters, it's going to take a little bit longer just because of the amount of the tape that has to be spooled out.
Yeah, but along the way, you can be listening, and as it gets to the right length, then your signal level will come up, I presume.
You'll typically hear a little bit of noise, but you won't necessarily hear the signals too well because we are moving in and out of that frequency coverage range pretty quickly.
Okay, can you give us an idea when this antenna is available and also the price range?
So the antenna is currently shipping. Typical turnaround time on a new order is about 3 business days in the warehouse before it's ready to ship. And the pricing is, I believe, still at $1,785.
Okay, so that's about $1,800 for the antenna and the control box, right?
Yes, it is the antenna and the control box. Again, as I stated earlier, you would order the control cable separately, and we just sell that by the foot for whatever length you need.
Okay, but I'm still missing a rotor. I have to add a rotor to the system, right?
You do need to add a rotor to the system. One of the nice things with the Urban Beam, it is fairly small and reasonably light for a stepper. So you can put it on, you know, a fairly modest rotator without having an issue.
Okay, could you give us a suggestion of a brand or model of rotor? What kind of class of rotor are we talking about?
Well, I don't like to make specific brand recommendations because we like too many of the rotator manufacturers, of course. But something similar to, say, like a Yaesu 800 would be more than adequate for this antenna.
Okay, great. Thanks so much. It's really nice meeting you, and good luck here at the show.
Oh, thank you very much, George. Appreciate you coming by the booth.
This episode of The Workbench is brought to you by Autodesk Eagle PCB Design Tools. All of our projects we're doing on The Workbench use Eagle. It's great for schematic capture and board layout. You can easily generate all of the output files necessary to manufacture a circuit board. And whether you're building one board or 100 boards for your friends, use Eagle Tools because they have really excellent support. They've got a great library of available components. It's widely used amongst the maker and the professional board design tool. You'll enjoy using the tools, and there's a lot of great new features. Check it out at autodesk.com/eagle, and you could download a free copy of the PCB design tool today and get started doing your project. In the next segment, we're going to hear about G8BBC. Our friends at the ICQ podcast kindly offered to make their audio available to us to play here on our show. This is the unveiling, the opening up of a new amateur radio station at Broadcasting House in London, England, the home of the BBC. And if you guys want to listen to a really good podcast, I highly recommend checking out ICQ Podcast.
An ICQ amateur ham radio podcast team comprising of Chris Howard, Mike Zero Tango Charlie Hotel, Martin Rothwell, Mike Zero Sierra Golf Lima, and myself, Colin M6BOY, were recently invited to the launch of the BBC's London Group G8BBC Radio Shack station launch. We've prepared a small roundup of the event, which I'm sure you'll find of interest. If you'd like to find out more information about the ICQ podcast, please visit www.icqpodcast.com. We start with Lord Tony Hall, the Director General of the BBC, cutting the ribbon to officially open G8BBC, and then making a greetings message to the special event station GB2 November Sierra, which is the HMS at Belfast station moored on the River Thames.
Absolutely, absolutely brilliant to have G8BBC once again here and in ASCII's Flat 2. So it's a real pleasure, and well done everybody, to declare this well and truly open.
Yay! The operator on the other end is Jürgen Faxholm, who's ex-Danish Navy telegraphist. GB2RM, Golf Bravo 2, Romeo November. This is Golf 8 Bravo Bravo Charlie calling over.
Yes, this is GB2RM from HMS Belfast responding, over.
GB2RM, the Golf 8 Bravo Bravo Charlie, good morning, old man. Your signal is 5 and 9 plus, 59 plus, over.
Yes, and you are coming through very, very nicely on the ground wave here to HMS Belfast with a 5 and 9, 9 being a very strong signal, over.
GB2RN, Golf 8, Bravo, Bravo, Charlie. I'd like to introduce Lord Hall, Tony Hall, who's Director General of the BBC, and he'd like to pass a greetings message, if that's okay with you, over.
Hello there, this is a really exciting moment for me. I have to say, it's Tony Hall here, the Director General of the BBC, speaking to you from station G8BBC in the new Radio Shack broadcasting house in London, right up here on the 8th floor. It's my huge pleasure to declare the new station officially open and to wish everybody here, the staff of the station, many years of successful operating from this, the original home of broadcasting. Good DX and 73 from Broadcasting House.
I was fortunate enough to spend some time with the Director General, Lord Tony Hall, after his successful contact, and I started off by asking him how he enjoyed working the station GB2NS.
I enjoyed it hugely. I mean, I was so impressed by all the call signs that go out before. I mean, I did the easy bit, which is just saying I'm declaring this open instead of plain English, though I learned a couple of things I didn't know. Good DX and 73, I now know what those mean. But I was so impressed, and I really do feel that although that is a kind of a transmission to HMS Belfast, which is what, just a couple of miles down on the river there, the notion that from here you can link up with whoever is out there, in kind of radio space, is very, very exciting and very wonderful. And it's wonderful to know that that is still continuing. And it seems to me, not only just continuing, but thriving. So to have this at the very top of broadcasting house is brilliant. I'm very pleased.
And it really does connect back to the history of the BBC as well, with radio and the amateur radio, Marconi, and those sort of things. Well, it really does cement that relationship with the history of the BBC as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it's part of the history of the BBC. I think there are so many very good stories about what's been done using this sort of equipment from the BBC in the past. But also for the future too. I think World Service Radio, World Service TV does a huge amount to contact people around the world and give them the information they need in a soft power in that sense. This is another form of that. And I think the contacts which can go on through here, people talk to each other globally, it's so important, indeed more important now than ever before.
Do you feel like it's a great opportunity as well for the staff of the BBC, maybe even yourself, to actually, you know, take the couple of weekends out to maybe with the foundation license and use the wonderful equipment that's on offer here?
Yeah. Well, I think just to be here and to use this today was absolutely fantastic. I'd love to find time to learn more about it. I really would. But I just admire hugely what's being done, and I wish everybody here the very best.
That's right. Well, congratulations, and say, hopefully the station's a wonderful success for the organisation.
I really hope so. I'm sure it will be too.
Following on from our interview with Lord Tony Hall, the BBC Director General, we were lucky enough to spend some time with Laurie Margones, Golf 3 uniform Mike Lima, who told my colleague Chris Howard, Mike Zero TCH, how he broke the news of the Argentinian invasion, which started the Falklands War.
Yeah, this goes back to 1982 and was from over the road from where we are. We're here in New Broadcasting House, where this news station has just been established. There used to be over the road in the Langham building, before it became the Langham Hotel, it was a BBC office block. And there was an amateur station up in the eaves there, G3AYC. It's a good station, had a beam up at about 200 feet above the street, and I used to go up there and use it occasionally. And when the Falklands conflict started, I was asked if we could get in touch with the Falklands, because nobody knew what was going on. We knew that something had happened there, but nobody knew what. So 2nd of April 1982, I went up there and listened around for some hours and eventually heard a station who I thought, this is definitely from the Falklands, from his accent, what he was saying. Subsequently realised it was VPHLP, Bob McLeod, who is still very much around. And I called him, said I was at the BBC in London. We had spoken before. And he said, Laurie, why is the BBC saying there's been no invasion? There's an Argentinian warship in the bay, Argentinian ships all over town. The broadcast station is broadcasting in Spanish and the governor is under house arrest. I said, right, well, we weren't exactly sure of that, but I guess we are now. And I went on the Radio 4PM program a short time afterwards with this information, which caused a bit of a sensation because it was the first confirmation that something had gone terribly wrong. The story obviously ran bigger and bigger. I was later called in by my editor that evening in an office here in Broadcasting House to have a press conference. And for many years was hoping, obviously the story was by and large right, but was hoping that it was entirely right. I was rung by the Foreign Office, who said, I understand you've been talking to the Falklands, what are they saying? So I told them what they were saying, Argentinian warship, Argentine troops all over town, governor under arrest. Not long afterwards, Lord Carrington, who was then Foreign Secretary, stood up in the House of Lords and announced that the invasion had happened. And it was only about 5 years ago, 30 years after the event in 2012, when the 30-year papers came out from the government, that there was one confirming my information and confirming that I was the sole source of that information, and also that it was correct as well. So 30 years later, it was nice to have all that confirmed.
What a fantastic story, and what a great, really showed amateur radio in, you know, really making history, you know, and absolutely, you know, essential to, you know, to news and to the government. A really great story. So, Laurie, thank you very much, and I wish you all the best.
Pleasure. Nice talking to you.
The ICQ Amateur Ham Radio Podcast, serving the amateur ham radio community fortnightly since 2008.
BBC Radio Group's Jonathan Kempster, Mike 5 Alpha Echo Oscar, then told the story to Chris Howard, Mike 0 TCH, about the fall and then rise again of the BBC Radio Group.
Alpha Radio, it re-energised it, and I thought, I could do a lot more than I'm doing. I've had 20 years of lying on the sofa doing nothing. What can I do? And one thing I was passionate about was this building, Broadcasting House. It's the home of broadcasting. It was the original broadcast center, the first broadcast center in the UK, and I thought it should have an amateur radio presence, really. We had this call sign, G8BBC. It was issued in 1972. It's waxed and waned over the years. When Broadcasting House was redeveloped about 10 years ago, we were co-sited over at TV Centre. We had a wonderful TV centre shack on the East Tower, 130 feet above ground, fully equipped. But our membership of the old aerial radio group dropped to four. Nice. At which point the BBC Club, which organised social activities amongst staff, said, look, I'm sorry, we can't support you anymore. You don't have enough members. You can keep the equipment. It's too much hassle for us to sell, but we're cutting you loose. Then we were told, oh, and by the way, you've got a month to get out. We're selling TV Centre. It's closing down.
Okay, right. So okay.
We very, very quickly distributed the remaining equipment amongst aerial radio group branches around the country. We kept this, the FT920, because I thought, maybe one day. And it's been in a wardrobe in my home for the last 4 years. And then G8BBC kind of went into a fallow period. It was me on the seventh floor balcony of BH with my handheld on a Saturday morning after the Today programme on the FM repeaters, and that was really it. We had no members, no organisation, no shack, no equipment, very little on-air presence.
So how did you go about going from that position to where you are today? You've got Lord Hall opening this fantastic facility, you've got a dedicated room here, you've got equipment, you've got donations from Kenwood's. A real success story. How have you gone from that position to where we are today?
Well, it's all happened relatively quickly. When we moved here from TV Centre 4 years ago, I started approaching the BBC facilities departments and saying, look, all we need is a cupboard-sized room near the roof. That's all we want, a desk and two chairs. Really, that's all we require. And they kept saying, no, 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 we can't do that, can't do that. And then towards the end of last year, in about September, I spoke to one of our duty operations managers, Clive Bergman, who's now a member of the group. He doesn't have his license yet, but I'm hopeful. He said, oh, you're talking to the wrong people. When you say amateur radio, they don't understand what you're talking about. You need to talk to Andy Baker. I said, well, who's he? Oh, he's head of engineering here. And I emailed Andy, and literally within 5 minutes, I had a reply saying, what frequencies, what power, what modes, where do you want your aerials? And by the way, would you like ASCII's flat, which is the room we're in now? It's an iconic room for people in the people who've been in the BBC as long as me, which is 31 years. Remember Arthur ASCII in the 1950s, who used to say, oh, I'm just off to Myth Flat. And he used to pretend he lived in Broadcasting House. And that this room, it's just an apparatus room, but it's known as ASCII's flat. Most of the equipment is migrating from here to New Broadcasting House, which is joined onto the building. So it's an empty room. And they said, why don't you have it? We, of course, me and Jim said, yes, please. And then things move very quickly from there. As you saw, we now have 36 members, the latest one being the Director General himself. People are enthusiastic. They're keen. There's a lot of people interested in the heritage of this building and this organisation. And I think people see the value of having an amateur presence here. And, you know, G8BBC, if Ofcom had revoked that, we'd never have got it back. Yeah. And that would have been a great shame. So I felt compelled. I had to act. And I got Jim Lee on board. And he was very keen and helpful. And we formed the London BBC Radio Group. Which is a totally independent group. We wanted independence. We don't want to be linked to the BBC Club, big and useful though they are. We don't want to be in the pocket of the BBC, and we want to be able to decide things for ourselves.
For all the news, links and information, visit www.icqpodcast.com.
Thanks again to our friends from the ICQ podcast, Martin, Colin, and all the regulars on that show. Again, if you're interested in finding a great ham radio podcast, check out the ICQ podcast. And thanks very much, you guys, for letting us use your audio in our program. It was really exciting. And for that matter, Jeremy, I would love to visit that station. I wonder if it will be open to the public.
I'm not sure. But not sure. You are more likely to be able to do that before I am, given that I've never been to the UK.
Ugh. You know where I really want to go there besides visiting that station? I want to go to Bletchley Park. You know what Bletchley Park is?
I do know what Bletchley Park was. In fact, actually, if you follow our friend Smitty on Twitter, he was just at Bletchley Park.
Was he really?
You didn't see that?
No, oh, yeah. I missed that.
He actually got to operate the ham radio station that's there. He got to see like the historic machines, and yeah.
That is awesome. I would love to go there. So I'm sure they have like the Enigma machine and all that stuff set up there, obviously. That would be where it'd be.
Yes.
Very cool. Yeah, I would love to go. I didn't know that their amateur station was on the air. I thought that it had closed a while ago.
I saw a picture of him operating a station that I'm 90% sure was at Bletchley Park, but I could be wrong. Oh,
very cool. Yeah. Well, there you go. Two reasons to go to the UK.
In addition to thanking our friends at the ICQ podcast, we want to thank again Flex Radio, Step IR, and Novex.com for speaking to us at Pacificon, and of course, our friends at PowerFilm Solar for the discount code.
And on the next show, we're going to have a special guest.
Ooh, do tell.
We're going to have David Schoaf from Elecraft to come on and talk about RF power amplifiers.
That's very topical given that they have launched the legal limit Elecraft amplifier this year.
So we want to get David on to talk about their product, but just amplifiers in general. And the question that I posed to David to think about is, if you're going to give advice to a ham who's never bought a big HF power amplifier, what would you look for? What are the features and what are the practical things you need to think about? Like, do you need to pull in 220 volts into your ham shack, or how much of an amplifier do you need? Does it really make a difference? All that basic stuff.
Yeah, like what are you going to drive it with, et cetera? What type of protections does it have? And of course, you know, you talk about the things, what are the things you need to know, but then what are the things that nobody ever thinks of when buying their first, high power amplifier?
Like buy extra fuses.
Yes. Or, I mean, honestly, for that matter, tube versus solid state.
Well, exactly. And do you have to buy an amplifier that's the same brand of radio that you own? So, okay. And how big of an amplifier? Are we talking about 500 watts or 1,000 watts? And, you know, what really makes a difference?
And then, you know, having that amount of power in the shack, how does that impact other things like feed line, antenna placement? Because, I mean, you know, we talk about being sensitive about 100 watt, into a dipole and worrying about RF exposure and RF burns. I couldn't imagine what would happen with a 1,500 watt monstrosity.
Exactly. So so stay tuned for that. We'll have that show in the next couple of weeks.
And as always, if you had feedback, comments, suggestions, show ideas, or interested in being a guest on the Workbench podcast, please feel free to send us an email to workbench@hamradio360. That's hamradio360.com. You can also find me on Twitter at KF7IJZ.
And I'm at KJ6VU.
Not that you ever check it, apparently.
Well, once in a while.
I was going to say, again, your beat is more Facebook. My beat is more Twitter.
My beat is more CW. 40 meters, man.
For more information about our show and Ham Radio 360, please check out the website at www.hamradio360.com. Until next time, 73.
73s.